This is Raising Reconciliation. By hearing, by listening, we search for understanding and solutions concerning issues affecting multiple Indigenous communities. This is a collaboration between Mount Royal University's Inniskim Center and the Calgary Journal. In this episode, we discuss the impacts of intergenerational trauma and how three Indigenous people are moving forward.
Good evening. My name is Alvin Mantopias, and I'm originally from the Muskogan First Nations Reserve, which is in southern Saskatchewan, Treaty 4 territory. And my background is I'm a Plains Cree, Anishinaabe, and Nakota. And I've lived here in Calgary since 1968. And I've worked for many years with Health Canada and Secretary of State. And I'm now retired from the federal government. I'm now employed with the Alberta Justice, and I write Gladue reports.
Good evening. My name is Veronica Marlowe. I am from Thutsulk Eyedene First Nation, which is located in the east arm of the Great Slave Lake, which is in Treaty 8 territory. I am Denis Lothine, and I'm a student here at Mount Royal University in the social work program.
Good evening. My name is Audra Foggin, and I am originally from Frog Lake First Nation. I'm Treaty 6. That means I'm Cree. And I'm happy to be here this evening. I am a 60 Scoop survivor, and I'm also a professor here at Mount Royal University in the social work faculty. Thank you for having us.
Well, I think that the general public views Indigenous people in this country, you know, what they see in the, first of all, in the urban centers, you know, you see some of our people that are homeless on the street, and so you get a lot of stereotypes that's happening. It's been happening for over 100 years now, and but they just see the surface of what's happening. There's some much deeper issues that's happening with those people and why they're in that situation, and it goes back a lot of historic experiences that our people have experienced, and it's been passed down from one generation to another generation.
Just going off what Alvin shared about, you know, the stereotypes of Indigenous people, I feel that the other thing about that, when you look at the behaviors of children, in my experience, that too often our Indigenous children are being put labels on them, such as you know, having behavioral problems, when really those are just, they stem from trauma, you know, that they've faced. Not all children, but some children, you know, they experience that. And I was actually reading about this topic the other day, and trying to get a greater understanding of what we're talking about, and trying to connect it and relate it to what I know. And what I've read, I wanted to share this, is Indigenous trauma. If you think about, like, pre-colonial trauma, it was predictable. And what I mean by that is that it's set in a cultural context. And, you know, when there was a death in the family, you know, everyone mourns and it's considered trauma. Or if there's starvation within the tribes or the nations, you know, during a bad winter, or, you know, whatever, or separation from family. Those were predictable trauma. And then along came colonization. And then colonization, you know, it created a climate of systematic oppression, which led to, you know, violence and abuse and all those negative things that have happened in our history. And those things that have happened, it's like Alvin said, it is carried on from one generation onto another. And it goes into the idea that Indigenous people have suffered from historical trauma and historical unresolved grief. And it comes out in different ways. It's shown in our populations today, in the homeless people, you know, in the families that are suffering from addiction. These are just things that are stemmed from those, from that history. Yeah.
Thank you. Building on what has been said already, I think it's important in a Western context to view it from a physiological aspect as well, because what we're finding out about trauma and cellular trauma is that we can see within cells those pieces of trauma that Veronica's spoken about and that Alex has spoken about, and that we know that it's in the cells of our body, and we know that it goes through generation to generation. I think so many times we do see the visible populations of Indigenous people in the cities, because we know that it's visible grief in the form of addictions and grief and loss, and the ways that Veronica has mentioned that those pieces of trauma come out and are visible. And so what I think that I would like people to know about intergenerational trauma is that it has those pieces of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and the pieces of grief and loss that are intracellular and live within us are often effaced through those processes, and understanding that trauma is connected to those. And then the historical aspects that we have in Canada are colonial injuries that have been so systemic and so longstanding and have affected us as Indigenous people in Canada, that those are all part of our process and have given life to trauma, and so given a reason for our trauma with the historical processes in Canada, we have to look back at our history to understand where we are today as Indigenous people with grief and loss and trauma.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think if we look back in history, I view the clash of cultures and worldviews. It's been happening since Europeans first stepped foot on Turtle Island here, and in the 15th century, the Pope issued out the doctrine of discovery, and in those papal bulls, basically gave the Europeans justification to destroy Indian people if they did not convert to Christianity. So that's where it all began, with that doctrine of discovery. And to this very day, we have Indigenous people that are lobbying the church and the Pope to rescind the doctrine of discovery. Because in that declaration, it calls for the, that's where you find the origins of dehumanization of Indigenous peoples, and also the conquest of the traditional territories of the Indian nations throughout the Western Hemisphere. And from there, throughout history, our Indian people, we have witnessed and went through the experience of losing our lands and being confined into to reserves, and which were very similar to concentration camps. And I think the biggest toll was when the whole residential school legacy occurred in Canada here. And that all goes back to the church and the government working together to change the Indigenous people, try and turn us into little brown white people, and destroy our culture, our languages, and our way of life, and which they viewed as evil, and they labeled us savages and pagans and so forth. So it's been a history of 500 years, and that's still occurring here in North America. We still see it today in the media. You know, we still experience the racism. And as Indigenous people, we all carry that that suffering. It's multi-generational trauma that our ancestors felt when they experienced being rounded up and herded into reservations, and also the wars and conflicts that occurred here in North America. You know, at the time of those battles, they experienced that post-traumatic stress, you know, similar to people who went through the World War I, World War II, and so forth. And it carries on to the next generation. And so we have a lot of our people still feeling that. And it's like something that we need to look at healing that hurt, and also having a dialogue on acknowledging that there was harm that was done to Indigenous nations here in North America. That what I'm talking about is it's the greatest Holocaust that ever happened in the whole history of the human race. And what I see happening right now is that it's our culture and our spirituality that's our source of strength in addressing that trauma. And I think that's the best healing strategy for Indigenous people.
I would like to add to that what Alvin has brought forward is, like, I see it as three distinct eras in Canada. When we look at historical context, we look at the residential school in the late 1800s that carried on right up till the 1990s. And when we look at the 60s scoop, we look at all the damage that was done through that era. And then now we look at child welfare today, and we see a connection between all three of these eras and how the snowball effect of trauma, of disconnecting not just from land and culture but from families, has continued right up to this day, and how we are looking at areas of reclamation and claiming our identity and restoring that. And some may use the term reconciliation. And how do we reconcile ourselves after these three really injurious events and eras in Canadians' history, in Canada's history? And I think that when we view intergenerational trauma in light and in connection to these eras, we can see that we are where we are today, but just starting to recognize who we are as Indigenous people and our culture, and reconnecting and reclaiming that is part of our process in overcoming this intergenerational trauma.
I just wanted to mention that there's a lot of people from different nations that have carried on their language, their culture, way of life. And it's shown in the ceremonies that are being done. You know, it's demonstrated in the languages that are being spoken in Canada. And despite all of the historical trauma and historical grief, you know, Indigenous people, you know, we are resilient, and it shows. And despite the, you know, negative portrayal of Indigenous people through the media, through the stereotypes, through the people that you see on the streets, it's like, we are resilient, you know. Some of us are coming home to communities where we never had, you know, attachment to the communities. You know, the children that, like Audra said, that were scooped up in the 60s, they're coming home. They're going home, and they're the ones that are reconnecting who they are as an Indigenous person to the culture that's still alive and vibrant in the communities. So The thing that I like to say is that when we're talking about trauma, you also, it's kind of have like negative context to it. But when you think about the other side of it, it shows our resiliency and all the things that we are. And even Alvin here, you know, he's the elder here in the community. Him being here and praying in his language, I don't know if you're aware that we smudged before we came and we sat down. So that's resilient, you know. That's what shows who we are. Yeah, I just wanted to put that out there.
I think these dialogues and discourses are vital and healing and not just a self-awareness piece for us as Indigenous people, but awareness piece for all Canadians. And I think for all of us to come together, for us all as treaty people, because we are all treaty people when we look at Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people. The treaties are there for all of us. And when we can acknowledge grief and loss and make more sense out of it and share our stories authentically with vulnerability, which is what we're doing here today, is sharing our stories and sharing our history, we're able to come to some sense of understanding, some sense of relational connection, and some sense of identifying with each other. And also, when we look at talking about our truth and sharing our stories in a very real manner, we also gain strength in telling our stories. I think that's really crucial to have these conversations.
Trauma can occur at any time to anybody in any community, and the elders talk about it when they're giving lectures out to young mothers who are expecting their child to come into the world, and to keep themselves, the peace and harmony. And for example, if an expected mother witnessed violence, you know, that may have an impact upon the child that she's carrying. And when the child is born and grows up, you know, there could be a defect of some sort, and it could be traced back to that the mother witnessing an incident of violence. And also the elders talk about about relations, having good relations with one another, and that we have a term. We say in Cree, it's pastahu, and if you did harm against another person, you know, that's going to come back to you. And then if that person doesn't, pay for that, it could be passed down to the next generation or even three generations. And we have elders who talk about, whenever one of their children or grandchildren is going to get coupled up with another person, they would study and talk about the history of that person's family to see if there was any incidents that may impact upon this current generation. And then they will also look at ways to heal so that that trauma will end at that generation. It will not continue on. And they also talk about trauma going back over 100 years, and people are still carrying that trauma. But each generation, it gets weaker and weaker. And we're starting to see a new generation of young people that are free from that historical trauma. And this younger generation is much more gifted as far as, their intellectual capacities, and they're starting to succeed in academic and higher learnings of in institutions across this country. And so we can see that happening, and it's, you know, generations are starting to be healed from that. And so it's important to understand that, you know, that each of us in our DNA, we carry a lot of that harm that is done in past generations, but we also carry a rich and beautiful traditions and culture and worldviews that have existed for thousands and thousands of years. And it's a very, very beautiful thing, and that we all have that within us. You know, if we go into the mountains, to sacred areas, and we can feel the beauty, the sacredness of the mountains and the water and the air and the trees, you know, that's very healing for people. So that's where we can find healing of our spirits. And it's important for young people to have that experience, and for parents to make sure that, you know, they experience the sacredness of Mother Earth. And that goes right down to our core as being an indigenous person.
When I think about facilitating a conversation about intergenerational trauma, I feel like the important thing to talk about is to acknowledge that the conversation that will happen could have some triggers or be healing. You know, it depends on the person and who's here, who's listening, who's speaking. Each person has some sort of tolerance of how much they're willing to listen to and how much they're willing to share. And talking about trauma could often lead to a self-awareness of trauma that they didn't know existed. So it's always important to have some sort of backup healing method, whatever that may be, from smudging to talking to an elder to writing about, just to deal with that. Because what I've noticed in the past, especially when I think back to my experience in working with the Truth and Reconciliation Inquiry, is that a lot of the stories that were shared was so much for people that were there that they had the need to go and smudge because it was too heavy to hear those hard stories. So they had support for the families that spoke their truth. And I feel like that's important. So I'm grateful that we had the chance to smudge before. And that's just a way of protecting my spirit and, you know, and having the opportunity to speak my truth without becoming, you know, overly emotional. Or
one of our greatest gifts that we have within ourselves is our humor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, despite everything that we've went through, you know, we were still able to laugh. And, mm-hmm. and you would see that in every community where there's indigenous people, you know. Mm-hmm. Some of them just love to laugh, and you know, that's one of our, I guess you can say, one of our tools, you know, to cope with you know, what has happened to us, you know. And I think that's very an integral part of our survival as indigenous people, you know. Mm-hmm. is our humor. And I see that, the value of it, you know, as a gift. And and the other thing I see what's happening is that, you know, with social media, indigenous people are able to communicate with one another, and they're able to relate, you know, what's happening with you know, their friends on Facebook. And And from there, they offer support, and I think it's a very valuable tool, and you know, it's very, very exciting to see that type of communication happening.
I was born in 1969. Oh, I'm dating myself. And I was born to a loving mother from Frog Lake First Nation. And I spent a lot of time in the hospital. I was quite sick. And through that time, a lot of issues came up for me with sickness. And during my first 2 years of life, I was in the hospital 265 days. So when we talk about attachment theory and the ability to build strong bonds, for me that wasn't really something that I would imagine that happened at an early age. When I look back at adverse childhood experiences, I think that was definitely something that was present in my life as a young person. The family that adopted me was not First Nation. First, I was, I should backtrack a bit, I was fostered and then I was adopted by a non-First Nation family. And when I look at power structures and societal ability to have a child come into their home and the way in which it was done, I can't really judge it because I don't know all the situations surrounding my foster care and my adoption. But I do know that my adopted family was in a higher power position than my First Nation family. And so I did come into care. I was adopted. And I have to say that I have a respect for both my First Nation family and for my adopted family. And it really was a different situation for myself because when I came into care and was adopted, the family who adopted me had not been able to have children for 8 years. So here I was, this little pearl, and I was taken into a family that I have to say, I won the parent lottery on both sides of my family with both my adoptive family and my indigenous birth family. And when I look at that and how I was really a benefactor of privilege, and I see my privilege from what it was from both, not just my indigenous family, because I look at the culture that I have that's there for me to reconnect with and claim, or reclaim, I should say. I'm really grateful for that. But I also look at my adoptive family and the privilege and the social status that they afforded to me as an individual. And yet it doesn't account for the cultural loss. It doesn't account for the loss of community. It doesn't account for my loss of my culture or my language. And those are the things that I lost. And so there's times when throughout my life that were so difficult as a child because you don't look like your biological family. So when I'm out with my dad, people would say to my dad, oh, your mom must be very dark-skinned. Or if I was out with my mom, they'd say, oh, your mom must be really dark. And also seeing the stereotypes growing up of the First Nation people in the community that my parents weren't giving me context and understanding for, not because they believed into it, but just because they weren't sure how to handle it. And they weren't sure how to connect me with culture, so they didn't. So that loss was complete for me. I didn't start to reconnect with my culture till my late 20s. And up till that time, there was this disconnect with my culture of who I was as an Indigenous person. There was there was a total disconnect. There was a denial of who I was as an Indigenous person, and a shame and a fear that went with that because I didn't know much, if anything, about my culture other than what I saw in the media, which at that time in the early 70s wasn't really correct. So my disconnect and my distance of who I was a huge disruption in my identity and a huge gap for me. And it was painful. I mean, there was all everything from bullying in childhood and to school to the social segregation in elementary school and junior high and high school, and really always trying to prove that I fit in when I clearly didn't, and trying to fit in in the non-First Nation world, trying to fit in a First Nation context, and not having any idea of how to do that. So it was a difficult time when I look back on it. And yet when I got to having children and wanting to know about my genetics and background, I knew I had to. So I went home to Frog Lake First Nation and found out who my family was, and found out there was people there that looked just like me, that were wonderful and lovely and loving and kind. And it was a time in my life that really I was starting to understand my culture through the Native American Studies program at University of Lethbridge, and starting to understand the historical context. So going in a 180 shift from here I'm ashamed to here I'm starting to understand, to I'm understanding the resilience and the pride that First Nation people have gone through, but still really looking for that connection to culture. Then going to a 60 Scoop conference and seeing that I'm not the only one. And one thing that I learned through that was, I'm not the only one. We're all, as people who are Indigenous, have been separated from culture, hungry for our culture, and just starting to learn about our culture. And I think I said I was born in 69, so now you know I'm 50. But just as a 50-year-old, starting to go on that path of reconnecting to my culture and to my family and to my people and to my history and learning about who I am and being okay with that, and also being vulnerable and telling you, this is where I'm at and this is what I'm learning. So that's my story. But I think what Alex said was very true. Like, I look at my sons and they've suffered pieces of intergenerational trauma and that disconnect, but they're stronger. They're out there. They're at law school. They're doing great things, and they're understanding where they're from, and they're looking for solutions to Indigenous social issues, and they're proud of who they are, and they know who they are because I've made that effort to reconnect. And it's slow, and it's in degrees, and everybody's at a different place. And as Indigenous people, what I think I'd also like society to know about intergenerational trauma is to be patient with us, because and know that we're all at different places, and that's okay, and we're not all traditional, and we're not all we're not all synonymous. We can't all be the same. We're all so diverse. That's what I have to say.
Do you want to go? Or do you want?
Yeah, the other thing regarding, the harm that's been passed down from generation to generation is that when you have a group of people that are oppressed over 100 years, you know, you're looking at four or five generations right there. And when these people experience a loss of their freedom and a loss of their land, a loss of their culture and their very being as being an Indigenous person, and when their whole culture and spirituality is being attacked, you know, by the government and the churches, and when that happens over a long period of time, you know, people eventually would get sick. And, you know, what's happening today, we have so many of our people that have diabetes and also many different types of sicknesses and cancers happening at a very alarming rate, you know. And it all goes back to, our lifestyle and the way that we've been conditioned over generations and also our diet, you know. At one time, you know, on the reserves, we were given rations, and, you know, if you look at, the white flour, the white sugar and the white lard and, you know, all that stuff, and, you know, we had to take those and add water, and next thing we started making bannock, you know, and today people call that traditional food, but I don't see it like that. To me, it's food from an era of oppression, mm-hmm. and we need to start looking at changing our diet, you know, to more traditional diets and also healthy diets that's available today, you know, organic foods and so forth. So I think that you know, once we start changing our diet, you know, we can change our lives, and also it's a form of decolonization, you know, and restoring our health back. And I see a lot of our our people going through that process right now.
I was born in Yellowknife, 1985, to my 18-year-old mother. And my parents were quite young when they had me. And it was my dad who actually raised me for the first 3 years of my life, and not my mother. My mother came back into my life when I was three. And then my parents stayed together. In the course of my first, I guess, 13 years of my life, I guess I should talk about my grandparents first before I talk about my parents. So my grandmother went to residential school for 10 years. So I've come from two very big families. I'm very fortunate. I have a lot of cousins. And anyways, the first 13 years of my life, you know, I grew up it was like good, bad kind of growing up. You know, there was good days where we'd go swimming, go out and for picnics and whatever, go on the, you know, land and whatnot. And the other was growing up in domestic violent home, addiction issues, like all these things. So I was often left to care for my younger brothers when my parents were out of commission, if you will. So I learned how to be independent at a very young age. And then when I was 15, I was sent to live with an aunt in Lethbridge. And when I lived there with her, I went to high school, and that's where I met my children's father. So I'm a teen mother. I was 17 when I had my first child, and I have three children with, I guess, my high school lover, or whatever you want to call my husband at the time. So, you know, for me, despite having all that stuff that I experienced as a child, and then being a child, having a child, one thing that I can take from my experience, and which also demonstrates my resiliency, is that I wanted to break the cycle of not having my kids experience the kind of childhood that I experienced. So I made the choice, and my children's father, we both made the choice, and something that still I'm proud to say is that my kids have not seen us under the influence of alcohol. And that was my way of breaking one cycle. Mind you know, we were young when we had kids, so the effects of intergenerational trauma, of not being able to communicate, not having, you know, role models to role model healthy relationship. So us being young and having children, you know, my kids have had trauma passed on to them, you know, and it shows in their anxiety, it shows in their behavior. They're older now. My children are 10, 13, and 15. And I can tell that they were affected from their father and I's fighting in front of them, because when we're in the same room, they often get tense, you know. It's like they're going back to when they were kids. So that's something that I'm still working on. My grandmother, my mom's mom, you know, she had her way of teaching us as children, not by telling us right from wrong, but telling us through stories. I have trauma, I have triggers, but now that I'm learning about it, it's helping me to know what those triggers are and dealing with it in a healthy way. Sometimes, you know, I won't recognize it right away, but when it comes out, then I realize, you know, I'm still healing and I'm still, you know, working on myself and trying to be a better person, better mom, you know.
Our people, we look at the natural order and the natural laws and our connection to that and to natural order. And it takes a certain sense of humility to say, I don't know about my culture. I don't know. I'm just learning right now. And the sense of ethical responsibilities that we have to one another and that we have to the earth and we have to ourselves. And I'm always impressed and humbled by the fact that we're all at different learning spaces, but we're able to come together to hold space for each other. And I think that society can take so many great lessons from Indigenous culture because we have that sense of connection to each other, to the land, and to ethical responsibilities about caring for the whole. And I think that if I would like to see one thing, it would be for all of society to really connect with Indigenous people and take the positive aspects and also stand in solidarity with those of us who are learning and healing. And I think all of society could also learn and heal together and take aspects of that process to stand behind and stand with us. And I love what my friend Ryan McMahon says, don't do anything about us without us. And you know, that is really lovely because I think that Indigenous people should lead the way in healing and in trauma studies and in coming together and holding safe spaces and holding space. But we certainly appreciate and love it when there's like solidarity. I think that's a really valuable piece. No, I'm just really thankful to be here and honored to be in the presence of Alvin. And I said Alex so many times because I had a conversation with my cousin from Frog Lake today, and she was dreaming about the grandparents, and I asked some questions, and his name is Alex. So I kept saying Alex because that was on my brain today. So I apologize, Alvin, but it's such a pleasure to be here with you, Alvin, and with you, Veronica. So thank you, and thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. I think in my past experience of talking about this topic, it's often left me feeling very negative. I think at that time, like, I must have been, like, you know, fresh on my healing journey. It's always, like left a heavy, like, feeling. But today I feel light, and it's, I guess, another way of healing. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to thank all of you for all your sharing, and I feel very honored to be part of this circle this evening. And I thank you very much, Jimmy Gwich.
Let's see.
You've been listening to Raising Reconciliation, a collaboration between Mount Royal University's Niskum Center and the Calgary Journal. Thanks to Audra Foggan, Veronica Marlowe, and Alvin Manitopius for participating. This episode was produced by Casey Bridgeson, Sarah Green, and Georgia Longfee. The music was created by Ricardo Andres Garcia. The podcast artwork was created by Dion Simon.